A Canticle for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 3, Side 1. Providence, however, took an earlier hand in the matter, without summoning the soul of Brother Jairus to its maker. During the summer which followed his appointment as master, a prothonotary apostolic and his retinue of clerks came by way of a donkey train to the abbey from New Rome. He introduced himself as Monsignor Malfredo Aguera, the postulator for the Beatus Leibowitz in the canonization procedure. With him were several Dominicans. He had come to observe the reopening of the shelter and the exploration of sealed environment. Also, to investigate such evidence as the abbey could produce that might have a bearing on the case, including, to the abbot's dismay, reports of an alleged apparition of the Beatus which had, so travelers said, come to one Francis Girard of Utah, Albertian Order of Leibowitz. The saint's advocate was warmly greeted by the monks, was quartered in the rooms reserved for visiting prelates, was lavishly served by 6 young novices instructed to be responsive to his every whim, although, as it turned out, Monsignor Aguera was a man of few whims, to the disappointment of would-be caterers. The finest wines were opened. Aguera sipped them politely but preferred milk. Brother Huntsman snared plump quail and chaparral cocks for the guests' table, but after inquiring about the feeding habits of the chaparral cocks, "Corn-fed, brother? No, snake-fed, messer." Monsignor Aguera seemed to prefer monk's gruel in the refectory. If only he had inquired about the anonymous bits of meat in the stews, he might have preferred the truly succulent chaparral cocks. Malfredo Aguera insisted that life go on as usual at the abbey, but, nevertheless, the advocate was entertained each evening at recreation by fiddlers and a troupe of clowns, until he began to feel that life as usual at the abbey must be extraordinarily lively, as lives of monastic communities go. On the third day of Aguera's visit, the abbot summoned Brother Francis. The relationship between the monk and his ruler, while not close, had been formally friendly since the time the abbot permitted the novice to profess his vows, and Brother Francis was not even trembling when he knocked at the study door and asked, "You sent for me, Reverend Father?"
"Yes, I did," Arcos said, then asked evenly, "Tell me, have you ever thought about death?"
"Frequently, my Lord Abbot."
"You pray to St. Joseph that your death will not be an unhappy one?"
Often, Reverend Father."
"Then I suppose you don't care to be suddenly stricken, to have someone use your guts to string a fiddle, to be fed to the hogs, to have your bones be buried in unconsecrated ground, eh?"
No, Magister Meus."
"I thought not, so be very careful about what you say to Monsignor Aguera."
You.
Arcos rubbed his chin and seemed lost in unhappy speculation. "I can see it too clearly. The Leibowitz cause is shelved. Poor brother is struck down by a falling brick. There he lies, moaning for absolution. In the very midst of us, mind you. And there we stand, looking down in pity, clergy among us, watching him croak his last, without even a last blessing on the lad, hell-bound, unblessed, unshrived, under our very noses. A pity, eh?"
"My lord?"
Francis squawked. "Oh, don't blame me. I'll be too busy trying to keep your brothers from carrying out their impulse to kick you to death."
"When?"
"Why, not at all, we hope. But you are going to be careful, aren't you, about what you say to the Monsignor? Otherwise I may let them kick you to death."
"Yes, but—"
"The postulator wants to see you at once. Please stifle your imagination and be certain about what you say. Please try not to think."
"Well, I think I can."
"Out, son, out."
Francis felt fright when he first tapped at Aguera's door, but he saw quickly that the fright was unfounded. The prothonotary was a suave and diplomatic elder, who seemed keenly interested in the small monk's life. After several minutes of preliminary amenities, he approached the slippery subject.
"Now about your encounter with a person who may have been the blessed founder of—"
"Oh, but I never said he was our blessed Liba—"
"Of course you didn't, my son, of course you didn't.
Now, I have here an account of the incident, gathered purely from hearsay sources, of course, and I'd like for you to read it, and then either confirm it or correct it."
He paused to draw a scroll from his case. He handed it to Brother Francis.
This version is based on travelers' stories. He added, only you can describe what happened firsthand, so I want you to edit it most scrupulously.
Certainly, Messer, but what happened was really very simple.
Read, then we'll talk about it, eh?
The fatness of the scroll made it apparent that the hearsay account was not really very simple. Brother Francis read with mounting apprehension. The apprehension soon grew to the proportions of horror.
You look white, son, said the postulator. Is something troubling you?
Messer, this... it wasn't like this at all.
No, but indirectly, at least, you must have been the author of it. How could it have been otherwise? Weren't you the only witness?
Brother Francis closed his eyes and rubbed his forehead. He had told the simple truth to fellow novices. Fellow novices had whispered among themselves. Novices had told the story to travelers. Travelers had repeated it to travelers. Until finally, this. Small wonder that Abbot Arkos had enjoined discussion. If only he had never mentioned the pilgrim at all.
He only spoke a few words to me. I saw him just that once. He chased me with a stick, asked me the way to the abbey, and made marks on the rock where I found the crypt. Then I never saw him again.
No halo?
No, Messer.
No heavenly choir?
No.
What about the carpet of roses that grew up where he walked?
No, nothing like that, Messer,
the monk gasped.
He didn't write his name on the rock?
As God is my judge, Messer, he only made those two marks. I didn't know what they meant.
Ah, well, sighed the postulator. Travelers' stories are always exaggerated, but I wonder how it all got started. Now, suppose you tell me how it really happened.
Brother Francis told him quite briefly. Agera seemed saddened. After a thoughtful silence, he took the fat scroll, gave it a parting pat, and dropped it into the waste bin.
There goes miracle number 7, he grunted.
Francis hastened to apologize. The advocate brushed it aside.
Don't give it a second thought. We really have enough evidence. There are several spontaneous cures, several cases of instantaneous recovery from illness caused by the intercession of the Beatus. They're simple, matter-of-fact, and well-documented. They're what cases for canonization are built on. Of course, they lack the poetry of this story, but I'm almost glad it's unfounded. Glad for your sake. The devil's advocate would have crucified you, you know.
I never said anything like, I understand. It all started because of the shelter. We reopened it today, by the way.
Francis brightened.
Did you find anything more of St. Leibowitz?
Blessed Leibowitz, please, Monsignor corrected.
No, not yet. We opened the inner chamber, had a devil of a time getting it unsealed. 15 skeletons inside, and many fascinating artifacts. Apparently the woman, it was a woman, by the way, whose remains you found, was admitted to the outer chamber, but the inner chamber was already full. Possibly it would have provided some degree of protection, if a falling wall hadn't caused the cave-in. The poor souls inside were trapped by the stones that blocked the entrance. Heaven knows why the door wasn't designed to swing inward.
The woman in the antechamber, was she Emily Leibowitz?
Agera smiled.
Can we prove it? I don't know yet. I believe she was. Yes, I believe, but perhaps I'm letting hope run away with reason. We'll see what we can uncover yet. We'll see.
The other side, as a witness present. I can't jump to conclusions. Despite his disappointment at Francis's account of the meeting with the pilgrim, Agera remained friendly enough. He spent 10 days at the archaeological site before returning to New Rome, and he left two of his assistants behind to supervise further excavation. On the day of his departure, he visited Brother Francis in the scriptorium.
They tell me you're working on a document to commemorate the relics you found, said the postulator.
Judging by the descriptions I've heard, I think I should very much like to see it.
The monk protested that it was really nothing, but he went immediately to fetch it, with such eagerness that his hands were trembling as he unpacked the lambskin. Joyfully, he observed that Brother Jairus was looking on, while wearing a nervous frown. The Monsignor stared for many seconds.
Beautiful, he exploded at last. What glorious color! It's superb!
Finish it, brother, finish it.
Brother Francis looked up at Brother Jairus and smiled questioningly. The master of the copy room turned quickly away. The back of his neck grew red. On the following day, Francis unpacked his quills, dyes, gold leaf, and resumed his labor on the illuminated diagram. Chapter 9. A few months after the departure of Monsignor Aguera, there came a second donkey train, with a full complement of clerks and armed guards for defense against highwaymen, mutant maniacs, and rumored dragons, to the abbey from New Rome. This time the expedition was headed by a Monsignor with small horns and pointy fangs, who announced that he was charged with the duty of opposing the canonization of the Blessed Leibowitz, and that he had come to investigate, and perhaps fix responsibility for, he hinted, certain incredible and hysterical rumors which had filtered out of the abbey and lamentably reached even the gates of New Rome. He made it evident that he would tolerate no romantic nonsense, as a certain earlier visitor perhaps had done. The abbot greeted him politely and offered him an iron cot in a cell with a south exposure, after apologizing for the fact that the guest suite had been recently exposed to smallpox. The Monsignor was attended by his own staff, and ate mush and herbs with the monks in the refectory, quail and chaparral cocks being unaccountably scarce that season, so the huntsman reported. This time the abbot did not feel it necessary to warn Francis against any too liberal exercise of his imagination. Let him exercise it, if he dared. There was small danger of the Advocatus Diaboli giving immediate credence even to the truth, without first giving it a thorough thrashing and thrusting his fingers into its wounds. "I understand you are prone to feigning spells," said Monsignor Flott, when he had Brother Francis alone and had fixed him with what Francis decided was a malign glare. "Tell me, is there any epilepsy in your family, madness, mutant neural patterns?"
"None, Excellency."
"I'm not an Excellency," snapped the priest. "Now we're going to get the truth out of you." A little simple, straightforward surgery should be adequate, his tone seemed to imply, with only a minor amputation being required.
"Are you aware that documents can be artificially aged?" he demanded.
Brother Francis was not so aware.
"Do you realize that the name Emily did not appear among the papers you found?"
"Oh, but it—"
He paused, suddenly uncertain.
"The name which appeared was M, was it not? Which might be a diminutive for Emily."
I believe that is correct, Monsieur.
"But it might also be a diminutive for Emma, might it not? And the name Emma did appear in the box."
Francis was silent.
"Well?"
"What was the question, Monsieur?"
"Never mind. I just thought I'd tell you that the evidence suggests that M was for Emma, and Emma was not a diminutive of Emily. What do you say to that?"
"I had no previous opinion on the subject, Messer, but—"
"But what?"
"Aren't husband and wife often careless about what they call each other?"
"Are you being flippant with me?"
"No, Messer."
"Now, tell the truth. How did you happen to discover that shelter, and what is this fantastic twaddle about an apparition?"
Brother Francis attempted to explain. The Advocatus Diaboli interrupted with periodic snorts and sarcastic queries, and when he was finished, the advocate raked at his story with semantic tooth and nail, until Francis himself wondered if he had really seen the old man, or had imagined the incident. The cross-examining technique was ruthless, but Francis found the experience less frightening than an interview with the abbot. The devil's advocate could do no worse than tear him limb from limb this one time, and the knowledge that the operation would soon be over helped the amputee to bear the pain. When facing the abbot, however, Francis was always aware that a blunder could be punished again and again, Arcos being his ruler for a lifetime and the perpetual inquisitor of his soul. And Monsignor Flott seemed to find the monk's story too distressingly simple-minded to warrant full-scale attack, after observing Brother Francis's reaction to the initial onslaught.
"Well, brother, if that's your story and you stick to it, I don't think we'll be bothered with you at all. Even if it's true, which I don't admit. It's so trivial it's silly. Do you realize that?"
"That's what I always thought, Messer," sighed Brother Francis, who had for many years tried to detach the importance which others had attached to the pilgrim.
"Well, it's high time you said so," Flott snapped.
"I always said that I thought he was probably just an old man."
Monsignor Flott covered his eyes with his hand and sighed heavily. His experience with uncertain witnesses led him to say no more. Before leaving the abbey, the Advocatus Diaboli, like the saint's advocate before him, stopped at the scriptorium and asked to see the illuminated commemoration of the Leibowitz blueprint, that dreadful incomprehensibility, as Flott called it. This time the monk's hands trembled not with eagerness but with fear, for once again he might be forced to abandon the project. Monsignor Flott gazed at the lambskin in silence. He swallowed thrice. At last he forced himself to nod.
"Your imagery is vivid," he admitted, "but we all knew that, didn't we?"
He paused.
"You've been working on it how long now?"
6 years, Messer, intermittently.
"Yes, well, it would seem that you have at least as many years to go."
Monsignor Flott's horns immediately shortened by an inch, and his fangs disappeared entirely. He departed the same evening for New Rome. The years flowed smoothly by, seaming the faces of the young and adding gray to their temples. The perpetual labor of the monastery continued, daily storming heaven with the ever-recurring hymn of the divine office, daily supplying the world with a slow trickle of copied and recopied manuscript, occasionally renting clerks and scribes to the episcopate, to ecclesiastical tribunals, and to such few secular powers as would hire them. Brother Jairus developed ambitions of building a printing press, but Arkos quashed the plan when he heard of it. There was neither sufficient paper nor proper ink available, nor any demand for inexpensive books in a world smug in its illiteracy. The copy room continued with pot and quill. On the Feast of the Five Holy Fools, a Vatican messenger arrived with glad tidings for the order. Monsignor Flott had withdrawn all objections and was doing penance before an icon of the Beatus Leibowitz. Monsignor Aguera's case was proved. The Pope had directed that a decree be issued recommending canonization. The date for the formal proclamation was set for the coming holy year, and was to coincide with the calling of a general council of the Church, for the purpose of making a careful restatement of doctrine concerning the limitation of the magisterium to matters of faith and morals. It was a question which had been settled many times in history, but it seemed to re-arise in new forms in every century, especially in those dark periods when man's knowledge of wind, stars, and rain was really only brief. During the time of the council, the founder of the Albertian order would be enrolled in the calendar of saints. The announcement was followed by a period of rejoicing at the abbey. Dom Arkos, now withered by age and close to dotage, summoned Brother Francis into his presence and wheezed,
"His Holiness invites us to New Rome for the canonization. Prepare to leave."
"Aye, my lord."
"You alone. Brother Pharmacist forbids me to travel, and it would not be well for Father Prior to leave while I am ill. Now don't faint on me again." Dom Arkos added querulously. "You're probably getting more credit than you deserve for the fact that the court accepted the death date of Emily Leibowitz as conclusively proved. But His High Holiness invited you anyway. I suggest you thank God and claim no credit."
Brother Francis tottered.
"His Holiness?"
"Yes. Now we're sending the original Leibowitz blueprint to the Vatican. What do you think about taking along your illuminated commemoration as a personal gift to the Holy Father?"
"Ah,"
said Francis. The abbot revived him, blessed him, called him a good simpleton, and sent him to pack his bindlestiff. Chapter 10. The trip to New Rome would require at least 3 months, perhaps longer, the time depending to some extent on the distance which Francis could cover before the inevitable band of robbers relieved him of his ass. He would be traveling alone and unarmed, carrying only his bindlestiff and begging bowl, in addition to the relic and its illuminated replica. He prayed that ignorant robbers would have no use for the latter, for indeed among the bandits of the wayside were sometimes kindly thieves who took only what was of value to them, and permitted their victim to retain his life, carcass, and personal effects. Others were less considerate. As a precaution, Brother Francis wore a black patch over his right eye. The peasants were a superstitious lot, and could often be routed by even a hint of the evil eye. Thus armed and equipped, he set out to obey the summons of the Sacerdos Magnus, that most holy lord and ruler, Leo Papas XXI. Nearly 2 months after leaving the abbey, the monk met his robber on a heavily wooded mountain trail, far from any human settlement except the Valley of the Mistborn, which lay a few miles beyond a peak to the west, where, leper-like, a colony of the genetically monstrous lived in seclusion from the world. There were some such colonies which were supervised by hospitallers of Holy Church, but the Valley of the Mistborn was not among them. Sports, who had escaped death at the hands of the forest tribes, had congregated there several centuries ago. Their ranks were continually replenished by warped and crawling things that sought refuge from the world, but some among them were fertile and gave birth. Often such children inherited the monstrosity of the parent stock. Often they were born dead or never reached maturity. But occasionally the monstrous trait was recessive, and an apparently normal child resulted from the union of sports. Sometimes, however, the superficially normal offspring were blighted by some invisible deformity of heart or mind that bereft them, seemingly, of the essence of humanity, while leaving them its appearances. Even within the church, some had dared espouse the view that such creatures truly had been deprived of the Dei Imago from conception, that their souls were but animal souls, that they might with impunity under the natural law be destroyed as animal and not man, that God had visited animal issue upon the species as a punishment for the sins that had nearly destroyed humankind. Few theologians, whose belief in hell had never failed them, would deprive their God of recourse to any form of temporal punishment. But for men to take it upon themselves to judge any creature born of woman to be lacking in the divine image was to usurp the privilege of heaven. Even the idiot, which seems less gifted than a dog, or a pig, or a goat, shall, if born of woman, be called an immortal soul, thundered the magisterium, and thundered it again and again. After several such pronouncements, aimed at curbing infanticide, had issued from New Rome, the luckless misborn had come to be called the Pope's nephews, or the Pope's children by some. Let that which is born alive to human parents be suffered to live, the previous Leo had said, in accordance with both the natural law and the divine law of love. Let it be cherished as child and nurtured, whatever its form and demeanor, for it is a fact available to natural reason alone, unaided by divine revelation, that among the natural rights of man, the right to parental assistance in an attempt to survive is precedent to all other rights, and may not be modified legitimately by society or state, except insofar as princes are empowered to implement that right. Not even the beasts of the earth act otherwise. The robber that accosted Brother Francis was not in any obvious way one of the malformed, but that he came from the Valley of the Mistborn was made evident when two hooded figures arose from behind a tangle of brush on the slope that overlooked the trail, and hooted mockingly at the monk from ambush, while aiming at him with drawn bows. From such a distance, Francis was not certain of his first impression that one hand grasped a bow with six fingers or an extra thumb, but there was no doubt at all that one of the robed figures was wearing a robe with two hoods, although he could make out no faces, nor could he determine whether the extra hood contained an extra head or not. The robber himself stood in the trail directly ahead. He was a short man, but heavy as a bull, with a glazed knob of a pate and a jaw like a block of granite. He stood in the trail with his legs spread wide and his massive arms folded across his chest, while he watched the approach of the small figure astride the ass. The robber, as best Brother Francis could see, was armed only with his own brawn and a knife, which he did not bother to remove from his belt thong. He beckoned Francis forward. When the monk stopped 50 yards away, one of the Pope's children unleashed an arrow. The missile whipped into the trail just behind the donkey, causing the animal to spurt ahead.
"Get off," the robber ordered.
The ass stopped in the path. Brother Francis tossed back his hood to reveal the eye patch and raised a trembling finger to touch it. He began lifting the patch slowly from his eye. The robber tossed back his head and laughed a laugh that might have sprung, Francis thought, from the throat of Satan. The monk muttered an exorcism, but the robber appeared untouched.
"You black-sacked jeebers wore that one out years ago," he said. "Now get off."
Brother Francis smiled, shrugged, and dismounted without further protest. The robber inspected the donkey, patting its flanks, examining teeth and hooves.
"Eat, eat!" cried one of the robed creatures on the hillside.
"Not this time," barked the robber. "Too scrawny."
Brother Francis was not entirely convinced that they were talking about the donkey.
"Good day to you, sir," the monk said pleasantly. "You may take the ass. Walking will improve my health, I think."
He smiled and started away. An arrow slashed into the trail at his feet.
"Stop that," howled the robber.
Then to Francis,
"Now strip, and let's see what's in that roll and in the package."
Brother Francis touched his begging bowl and made a gesture of helplessness, which brought only another scornful laugh from the robber.
"I've seen that alms pot trick before, too," he said. "The last man with a bowl had half a hecklo of gold hidden in his boot. Now strip."
Brother Francis, who was not wearing boots, hopefully displayed his sandals, but the robber gestured impatiently. The monk untied his bindle-stiff, spread its contents for display, and began to undress. The robber searched his clothing, found nothing, and tossed the clothing back to its owner, who breathed his gratitude. He had been expecting to be left naked on the trail.
"Now let's see inside that other package."
"It contains only documents, sir," the monk protested, "of value to no one except the owner."
"Open it."
Silently, Brother Francis untied the package and unwrapped the original blueprint and the illuminated commemoration thereof. The gold leaf inlay and the colorful design flashed brilliantly in the sunlight that filtered through the foliage. The robber's craggy jaw dropped an inch. He whistled softly.
"What a pretty. Now, wouldn't a woman like that to hang on the cabin wall?"
Francis went sick inside.
"Gold!"
the robber shouted to his robed accomplices on the hill.
"Eat, eat!"
came the gurgling and chortling reply.
"We'll eat, never fear," called the robber, then explained conversationally to Francis. "They get hungry after a couple of days just sitting there. Business is bad. Traffic is light these days."
Francis nodded. The robber resumed his admiration of the illuminated replica. "Lord, if thou hast sent him to test me, then help me to die like a man, that he may take it only over the dead body of thy servant. Holy Leibowitz, see this deed and pray for me."
"What is it?" the robber asked. "A charm?"
He studied the two documents together for a time.
"Oh, one is a ghost of the other. What magic is this?"
He stared at Brother Francis with suspicious gray eyes.
"What is it called?"
Transistorized control system for Unit 6B, the monk stammered.
The robber, who had been looking at the documents upside down, could nevertheless see that one diagram involved a figure-background reversal of the other, an effect which seemed to intrigue him as much as the gold leaf. He traced out the similarities in design with a short and dirty forefinger, leaving a faint smudge on the illuminated lambskin. Francis held back tears.
"Please," the monk gasped. "The gold is so thin it's worth nothing to speak of. Weigh it in your hand. The whole thing weighs no more than the paper itself. It's of no use to you. Please, sir, take my clothing instead. Take the donkey, take my bindle-stiff, take whatever you will, but leave me these. They mean nothing to you."
The robber's gray gaze was meditative. He watched the monk's agitation and rubbed his jaw.
"I'll let you keep your clothes and your donkey and everything except this," he offered. "I'll just take the charms, then."
"For the love of God, sir, then kill me, too," Brother Francis wailed.
The robber snickered.
"We'll see. Tell me what they're for."
"Nothing. One is a memento of a man long dead, an ancient. The other is only a copy."
"What good are they to you?"
Francis closed his eyes for a moment and tried to think of a way to explain.
"You know the forest tribes, how they venerate their ancestors?"
The gray eyes of the robber flashed angrily for a moment.
"We despise our ancestors," he barked. "Cursed be they who gave us birth."
"Cursed! Cursed!"
echoed one of the shrouded archers on the hillside.
"You know who we are? Where we are from?"
Francis nodded.
I meant no offense.
The ancient whose relic this is, he is not our ancestor. He was our teacher of old. We venerate his memory. This is only like a keepsake, no more.
What about the copy?
I made it myself. Please, sir, it took me 15 years. It's nothing to you. Please, you wouldn't take 15 years of a man's life for no reason.
15 years?
The robber threw back his head and howled with laughter.
You spent 15 years making that?
Oh, but... Francis was suddenly silent. His eyes swung toward the robber's stubby forefinger. The finger was tapping the original blueprint.
That took you 15 years, and it's almost ugly beside the other.
He slapped his paunch and, between guffaws, kept pointing at the relic.
Ha! 15 years. So that's what you do way out there. Why? What is the dark ghost image good for? 15 years to make that? Oh, what a woman's work.
Brother Francis watched him in stunned silence. That the robber should mistake the sacred relic itself for the copy of the relic left him too shocked to reply. Still laughing, the robber took both documents in his hands and prepared to rip them both in half.
Jesus, Mary, Joseph!
The monk screamed and went to his knees in the trail.
For the love of God, sir!
The robber tossed the papers on the ground.
I'll wrestle you for them, he offered sportingly. Those against my blade.
Done,
said Francis impulsively, thinking that a contest would at least afford heaven a chance to intervene in an unobtrusive way. O God, thou who strengthened Jacob so that he overcame the angel on the rock. They squared off. Brother Francis crossed himself. The robber took his knife from his belt thong and tossed it after the papers. They circled. 3 seconds later, the monk lay groaning on the flat of his back under a short mountain of muscle. A sharp rock seemed to be severing his spine.
Heh-heh, said the robber, and arose to reclaim his knife and roll up the documents.
Hands folded as if in prayer, Brother Francis crept after him on his knees, begging at the top of his lungs.
Please, then, take only one, not both. Please!
You've got to buy it back now, the robber chortled. I won them fair enough.
I have nothing. I am poor.
That's all right. If you want them that bad, you'll get gold. 2 heklos of gold. That's the ransom. Bring it here any time. I'll tuck your things in my shanty. You want them back, just bring the gold.
Listen, they're important to other people, not to me. I was taking them to the Pope. Maybe they'll pay you for the important one, but let me have the other one just to show them. It's of no importance at all.
The robber laughed over his shoulder.
I believe you'd kiss a boot to get it back.
Brother Francis caught up with him and fervently kissed his boot. This proved too much for even such a fellow as the robber. He shoved the monk away with his foot, separated the 2 papers, and flung one of them in Francis's face with a curse. He climbed aboard the monk's donkey and started riding it up the slope toward the ambush. Brother Francis snatched up the precious document and hiked along beside the robber, thanking him profusely and blessing him repeatedly, while the robber guided the ass toward the shrouded archers.
15 years,
the robber snorted, and again shoved Francis away with his foot.
Be gone.
He waved the illuminated splendor aloft in the sunlight.
Remember, 2 heklos of gold will ransom your keepsake, and tell your pope I won it fair.
Francis stopped climbing. He sent a glowing cross of benediction after the departing bandit, and quietly praised God for the existence of such selfless robbers who could make such an ignorant mistake. He fondled the original blueprint lovingly as he hiked away down the trail. The robber was proudly displaying the beautiful commemoration to his mutant companions on the hill.
Eat, eat,
said one of them, petting the donkey.
Ride, ride,
corrected the robber.
Eat later.
But when Francis had left them far behind, a great sadness gradually engulfed him. The taunting voice still rang in his ears. 15 years. So that's what you do over there? 15 years. What a woman's work. Ho, 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 ho. The robber had made a mistake, but the 15 years were gone anyhow, and with it all the love and torment that had gone into the commemoration. Cloistered as he had been, Francis had become unaccustomed to the ways of the outside world, to its harsh habits and curt attitudes. He found his heart deeply troubled by the robber's mockery. He thought of Brother Jairus's gentler mockery of earlier years. Maybe Brother Jairus had been right. His head hung low in his hood as he traveled slowly on. At least there was the original relic. At least. Chapter 11. The hour had come. Brother Francis, in his simple monk's habit, had never felt less important than at that moment, as he knelt in the majestic basilica before the beginning of the ceremony. The stately movements, the vivid swirls of color, the sounds which accompanied the ceremonious preparations for ceremony, already seemed liturgical in spirit, making it difficult to bear in mind that nothing of importance was happening yet. Bishops, monsignory, cardinals, priests, and various lay functionaries, in elegant, antiquated dress, moved to and fro in the great church, but their comings and goings were graceful clockwork, which never paused, stumbled, or changed its mind to rush in the other direction. A St. Petrius entered the basilica. So grandly was he attired that Francis at first mistook the cathedral workman for a prelate. The St. Petrius carried a footstool. He carried it with such casual pomp that the monk, if he had not been kneeling, might have genuflected as the object drifted by. The St. Petrius dropped to one knee before the high altar, then crossed to the papal throne, where he substituted the new footstool for one which seemed to have a loose leg. Thereupon, he departed by the same route as he had come. Brother Francis marveled at the studied elegance of movement that accompanied even the trivial. No one hurried, no one minced or fumbled, no motion occurred which did not quietly contribute to the dignity and overpowering beauty of this ancient place, even as the motionless statues and paintings contributed to it. Even the whisper of one's breathing seemed to echo faintly from distant apses. Terribilis est locus iste, hic domus Dei est, et porta caeli. Terrible indeed, house of God, gate of heaven. Some of the statues were alive, he observed after a time. A suit of armor stood against the wall a few yards to his left. Its mailed fist held the staff of a gleaming battle-axe. Not even the plume of its helmet had stirred during the time Brother Francis had been kneeling there. A dozen identical suits of armor stood at intervals along the walls. Only after seeing a horsefly crawl through the visor of the statue on his left did he suspect that the warlike husk contained an occupant. His eye could detect no motion, but the armor emitted a few metallic creaks while it harbored the horsefly. These, then, must be the papal guard, so renowned in knightly battle, the small private army of God's first vicar. A captain of the guard was making a stately tour of his men. For the first time, the statue moved. It lifted its visor in salute. The captain thoughtfully paused and used his kerchief to brush the horsefly from the forehead of the expressionless face inside the helmet before passing on. The statue lowered its visor and resumed its immobility. The stately decor of the basilica was briefly marred by the entrance of pilgrim throngs. The throngs were well organized and efficiently ushered, but they were patently strangers to this place. Most of them seemed to tread on tiptoe to their stations, cautious to create no sound and as little movement as possible, unlike the St. Petrii and new Roman clergy who made sound and motion eloquent. Here and there among the pilgrims, someone stifled a cough or stumbled. Suddenly the basilica became warlike as the guard was strengthened. A new troop of mailed statues tramped into the sanctuary itself, dropped to one knee and tilted their pike staffs, saluting the altar before taking their posts. Two of them stood flanking the papal throne. A third fell to his knees at the throne's right hand. He remained kneeling there with the sword of Peter lying across his upraised palms. The tableau became motionless again, except for occasional dancing of flame among the altar candles. Upon the hallowed silence burst a sudden peal of trumpets. The sound's intensity mounted until the throbbing ta-ra, ta-ra-ra could be felt upon one's face and grew painful to the ears. The voice of the trumpets was not musical, but annunciatory. The first notes began in mid-scale, then climbed slowly in pitch, intensity, and urgency, until the monk's scalp crawled, and there seemed to be nothing at all in the basilica but the explosion of the tubas. Then, dead silence, followed by the cry of a tenor. First cantor. A propinquat agnis pastor et ovibus pascendis. Second cantor. Genua nunc flaccantur omnia. First cantor.
Iusit olim Iesus Petrum, pascere gregem Domini. Second Cantor. Ecce Petrus Pontifex Maximus. First Cantor. Gaudeat igitur populus Christi, et gratias agat Domino. Second Cantor. Nam docebimur a Spiritu Sancto. Choir. Alleluia, Alleluia. The crowd arose and then knelt in a slow wave that followed the movement of the chair containing the frail old man in white, who gestured his blessings to the people as the gold, black, purple, and red procession moved him slowly toward the throne. Breath kept choking up in the throat of the small monk from a distant abbey in a distant desert. It was impossible to see everything that was happening, so overwhelming was the tide of music and motion, drowning one's senses and sweeping the mind along willy-nilly toward that which was soon to come. The ceremony was brief. Its intensity would have become unendurable had it been longer. A Monsignor, Malfredo Aguera, the saint's advocate himself, Brother Francis observed, approached the throne and knelt. After a brief silence, he voiced his plea in plain chant. Sancte Pater, ab sapientia summa petimus, ut ille beatus libuit, cuius miracula mirati sunt multi. The request called upon Leo to enlighten his people by solemn definition concerning the pious belief that the Beatus Libuits was indeed a saint, worthy of the dulia of the Church, as well as the veneration of the faithful.
Gratissima nobis causa fili, the voice of the old man in white sang in response,
explaining that his own heart's desire was to announce by solemn proclamation that the blessed martyr was among the saints, but also that it was by divine guidance alone, sub ducatu sancti spiritus, that he might comply with Aguera's request. He asked all to pray for that guidance. Again the thunder of the choir filled the basilica with the litany of the saints. Father of heaven, God, have mercy on us. Son, repurchaser of the world, God, have mercy on us. Ghost most holy, God, have mercy on us. O sacred threefoldhood, God, one and only, miserere nobis. Holy Mary, pray for us. Sancta Dei Genitrix, ora pro nobis. Sancta Virgo Virginum, ora pro nobis. The thunder of the litany continued. Francis looked up at a painting of the Blessed Libuits, newly unveiled. The fresco was of heroic proportions. It portrayed the trial of the Beatus before the mob, but the face was not wryly smiling as it smiled in Fingo's work. It was, however, majestic, Francis thought, and in keeping with the rest of the basilica. Omnes sancti martires, orate pro nobis. When the litany was finished, again Monsignor Malfredo Aguera made his plea to the Pope, asking that the name of Isaac Edward Libowitz be formally enrolled in the calendar of saints. Again the guiding spirit was invoked, as the Pope chanted the Veni Creator Spiritus. And yet a third time Malfredo Aguera pleaded for the proclamation, Surgat ergo Petrus ipse. At last it came. The 21st Leo intoned the decision of the Church, rendered under the guidance of the Holy Spirit, proclaiming the existing fact that an ancient and rather obscure technician named Libowitz was truly a saint in heaven, whose powerful intercession might, and of right ought to be, reverently implored. A feast day was named for a mass in his honor.
Holy Libowitz, intercede for us, Brother Francis breathed with the others.
This book is continued at this point.